What is the No Spin News all about?
You know that this is a fact-based analysis news program. You know that. We avoid speculation. We don't do conspiracies here. We don't do party politics here. We're not nonpartisan. That's wrong. Not that. Okay, we are advocates for a stronger America and a more just society. We don't believe in communism. We don't believe in socialism. We don't believe in nihilism. We don't believe in the progressive woke culture. We think it is un-American. We don't support that. So you should know what we are. And it would then crystallize what we do.
Listen to the No Spin News. Subscribe to Bill O'Reilly's podcast feed wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Josh Hammer, and welcome back to America on Trial, your one-stop shop for all your legal news pertaining to the 2024 presidential election and all the major pressing legal headlines for the matter affecting our great country and our American way of life. On today's show, we're going to take a deep dive into the Arizona Supreme Court's decision this week when it comes to abortion. We touched on it briefly during yesterday's show. I think it's worth exploring a little bit more in depth, both the law and the politics of what is a huge decision that really is going to complicate the election in potentially unforeseen ways in one of the nation's preeminent swing states. All of that and more in today's deep dive. Then later in the show, in today's closing argument, probably by the time you listen to this, I will be on a plane up to Boston, Massachusetts. I'm doing a two-on-two debate tonight right across the street from Harvard University in Cambridge. We're going to talk about what I'm debating and why I think it's important. You can also, by the way, register for that debate and tune in. All of that and more in today's closing argument. But first, as always, let's start by going around the horn. We begin with just a couple of brief calendar notes. So first, in Fulton County, Georgia, today was the deadline day for Fani Willis to submit her reply motion explaining why the appellate court sitting above Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee should not even consider trying to overturn her dismissal from the case. She actually filed that motion earlier this week. She got it out of the way already. So that is where things stand in Fulton County. We are now waiting to hear from the appellate court sitting above Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee as to whether or not they're even going to consider overturning McAfee's decision to allow Fani Willis to remain on the case. From Fulton County up to Washington, D.C., just a brief note that this Monday, April 15th, is the deadline for Donald Trump to file a reply brief in the immunity case. That would be a brief replying to Jack Smith's arguments, the special counsel's arguments earlier this week. Smith advanced a lot of the arguments that we expected that he would make in that case, talking about how immunity is inapplicable here, takes a very limited view of presidential immunity. So if Trump's lawyers wish to file a reply brief in that case, that is going to be due on Monday, April 15th. From Washington, D.C., up to New York. So really all eyes right now are on the impending commencement of Donald Trump's criminal trial, the first criminal prosecution of an ex-president and a major leading presidential candidate. That's going to start on Monday at this point. And it's worth noting that yesterday on Wednesday was the third time in 3 days that Trump's attorneys tried to delay this thing even further, and they were unsuccessful in doing so. So as we've discussed on the show, on Monday, Trump's attorneys tried a last-minute Hail Mary to basically protest and say that there was no way that their client, Donald Trump, could possibly get a fair trial in Manhattan, in New York County, New York, and therefore they tried to move the case from Manhattan to Staten Island, which is the only right-leaning, Republican-leaning of all the boroughs of New York City. That was rejected. Then on Tuesday, April 9th, they tried to delay the trial start date, this time on the grounds that they had to wait to hear whether or not Trump's gag order in this case could be limited, because his gag order is really so extreme in this case. It essentially covers everyone other than the judge, Juan Merchan or Alvin Bragg themselves. That attempt to delay the start date was also rejected. And then on Wednesday, the latest attempt to delay the trial was rejected by New York State Appellate Court Judge Ellen Gesmer. This was an attempt to basically, once again, make the argument that Judge Mearsham is compromised and that he cannot sit on this case and he must recuse because his daughter, Lauren Mearsham, is involved with the Democratic fundraising and political consulting group Authentic Campaigns, and her clients are actually profiting off of the judge's work and potential incarceration of Donald Trump. She's profiting off of this. So that was rejected yet again. So Trump's lawyers are 0-3. I'm not surprised by this. I anticipated that this was going to be the case. This thing's going to start on Monday, folks. And wow, I mean, there's going to be a lot of courtroom cameras. That's probably going to take up a lot of our time here on America on Trial over the next couple of weeks as we start to dive in to the first ever criminal prosecution of a former president of the United States. What a crossing of the Rubicon it's going to be. By the way, just a quick note, long piece out this morning from Politico by Ankush Kardori, how Trump could pull off an upset victory in court. Really interesting. Gave it a quick skim before I came on to talk with you all this morning. And we'll see. I mean, I can't say that I'm terribly optimistic about Trump's chances here in New York City. I hope that I'm wrong, but interesting that Politico is saying that Trump could pull off an upset. We're going to be talking about this trial a lot starting on Monday. Staying in New York City for just a minute here, former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg was sentenced. He was sentenced to 5 months in prison on Wednesday for lying under oath for perjury. This was part of Tish James's civil fraud investigation into the Trump Organization. Weisselberg has been sentenced to 5 months in jail. This is not the first time that Alan Weisselberg has been sentenced to jail time pursuant to his longstanding work over many decades working for the Trump Organization. In fact, going back to 2022, he actually pled guilty in a separate tax fraud case against the Trump Organization and was sentenced to serve 5 months in jail. So, look, Alan Weisselberg is a longtime executive of the Trump Organization. He has been extraordinarily loyal to the Trump Organization and to the Trump family here. And the sentencing yesterday to 5 months in prison comes just over a month after he pled guilty to two perjury counts. So this is going to be his second stint in jail in just a few years pertaining to tax fraud and now this Tish James fraud case. The Tish James fraud case, by the way, hopefully we'll get some more updates on that case for y'all soon as well. Staying on the topic of Trump for now, but going down to my state, the state of Florida, Trump yesterday said that Florida is, quote, probably going to change their abortion laws in November. Now, it was about a week and a half ago that the Florida Supreme Court greenlit a radical pro-abortion ballot initiative to go before the people of Florida on the ballot this November. It would essentially overturn the present 15-week/6-week abortion ban and then go far beyond that. It is a fairly radical measure with probably very liberal mental health exceptions that could potentially allow abortion on demand essentially up until the moment of birth or at least deep into the second or, God forbid, the third trimester. It's really not helpful. It's just not helpful for Donald Trump to make these comments. I mean, why are you going to say that Florida is probably going to change their abortion law? First of all, there's a 60% threshold here in the state of Florida for a ballot initiative to pass. That alone means that it is arguably more likely than not to not pass. Because if you look at other states, states like Ohio and Michigan, these ballot initiatives, they do pass, but they pass by a roughly 56 or 57 to 43% margin or so. So that's not 60%. So, I mean, why are you going to just predict something that is not necessarily based on how results have come in other states? Second of all, if you're going to say that, you're trying to almost kind of will it into power, aren't you? I mean, the far better approach to this would be to say that, no, this is radical and that the people of Florida should vote it down. You know, Trump has taken a very states' rights approach to the issue of abortion. We've discussed that on the show this week, and my syndicated column will be on this topic out tomorrow. But even within the paradigm, even within the construct of so-called states' rights, Trump, you are a Floridian. You are a Floridian. You are a citizen of our state, the Sunshine State. You should be outspoken on this, and it is deeply unhelpful to the cause of human life on the ballot before the people of Florida this fall to simply just assert that Florida is going to change their abortion laws. I was unhappy, frankly, when I saw that. Our final Around the Horn update for today: a group of 19 Republicans going up in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. House yesterday blocked the FISA surveillance bill from proceeding further in a procedural vote. The procedural vote failed 193 to 228. This was led by Another Florida man, Matt Gaetz. You had Chip Roy, the constitutional stalwart of Texas, who was involved here as well. Here, basically, they felt that there were improper warrant protections to prevent the feds from snooping on Americans here, getting caught up in the Section 702 FISA surveillance. FISA surveillance under Section 702 is designed to surveil not Americans, but to surveil foreign communications. However, because of the nature of the metadata and how this gets swept up, you will sometimes get Americans swept up in this process when they are in contact with foreigners located abroad. Therefore, you're going to need some sort of Fourth Amendment warrant protections in there. Look, I don't have necessarily super strong instincts on the FISA debate. On the one hand, I recognize that this is probably a prudential tool in theory at a time when we have hostile regimes and terrorists on the march all around the world. On the other hand, we have obviously seen time and time again how the FBI, the CIA, and the deep state is just totally untrustworthy when it comes to the various tools that we give them. They have consistently abused their powers. So I think it's somewhat of a judgment call as to how you balance those two competing priorities. So I'm not necessarily upset about this going down in flames, but you probably need some sort of measure. But I would agree that those warrant protections are very necessary. That's it for today's Around the Horn segment. Up next in today's deep dive, what's going on out in Arizona? We've discussed it a little bit when it comes to the Supreme Court's ruling on the ever-pressing issue of abortion. We're going to dive back in, all of that and more, when we come back.
I'm Mike Slater from the podcast Politics by Faith. This is a crazy time in our country. It's stressful, a lot of anxiety, and it's going to get worse. And I realized that one of the things that helps me take away the stress is realizing that there's nothing new under the sun. So on this podcast, we take the news of the day and we run it through the Bible and other periods in history to realize that we've been through this before and we can rise above again. Politics by Faith, anywhere you listen to the podcast. Politics by Faith.
Welcome back. It's time for today's deep dive. So we've covered on the show a little bit what the Arizona Supreme Court did this week when it comes to the issue of abortion. So Arizona had an 1864 law. And if you're sitting there wondering how this is possible, well, Arizona was obviously not even a state in 1864. It was very much just a territory. But when you have a territory that becomes a state, the state will assume the laws that were passed when the state was merely a territory. So they had this 1864 law going back to the Civil War era that amounts to something closely tantamount to a full abortion ban. There are basically only dispensations to save the life of the mother, which incidentally happens to be my own personal stance on this matter. I think that it is the principled pro-life stance to take. In any event, that was the law on the books in Arizona from 1864 onward, including when Arizona became a state, all the way up until the Roe versus Wade constitutional atrocity of 1973. And then in 2022, in March 2022, on the precipice of the Dobbs abortion case getting a ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court as to whether Roe versus Wade would be overturned, on the precipice of that, the Arizona legislature passed and Governor Doug Ducey signed into law a 15-week abortion ban. Now, the question arose and was decided by the Arizona Supreme Court this week. What is the actual law of the land in the state of Arizona? Is it this 1864 law or is it a 2022 law? And what the court decided was that the March 2022 law did not supersede the 1864 law. And that seems to me, based on my reading of the statute, to just be the straightforward and obviously correct legal result. In fact, the March 2022 statute has some fairly explicit language to the extent that it is not overturning the 1864 law. If you think back, and it's very difficult to say, obviously I'm not an Arizona legislator, but if you think back to what the legislature and what Doug Ducey were probably trying to accomplish with this March 2022 law, first of all, they didn't actually know whether the Dobbs abortion case would come down correctly and therefore overturn Roe versus Wade. So they were probably thinking that there was a real possibility that Roe would not be overturned, and therefore potentially Arizona might want another shot at the apple to try to overturn it. So that is a possibility as well. And then you could also just have some sort of good old-fashioned political incentive. I mean, maybe you have a lot of folks running for re-election. They want to shore up their conservative bona fides. Not that a 15-week abortion ban is frankly all that stringent or anything like that, but you potentially have all sorts of political incentives at work there as well. So it seems to me like the fairly obviously correct legal ruling. So the 1864 law, for now at least, continues to be the law of the land there in Arizona, albeit abortion clinics can continue their dirty and gruesome work for at least a short amount of time before the law actually literally kicks into effect. Now, the politics of this are fascinating and potentially quite disheartening, actually, quite disheartening from a pro-life perspective. So after the Arizona Supreme Court handed down this ruling the other day, you had some of the most prominent Republicans in the entire state of Arizona, including the governor who signed this March 2022 law into law, Doug Ducey himself, as well as Carrie Lake, the current U.S. Senate candidate out there in Arizona, formerly the gubernatorial candidate during the 2022 cycle when she lost a close election. You had both Doug Ducey and Carrie Lake run away from the Arizona Supreme Court ruling, say that this was a mistake, it is out of touch with Arizonans here. Look, it's complicated stuff. This is a complicated issue. It's made more complicated by the fact that Arizona has a radical pro-abortion ballot initiative in front of the voters of Arizona this fall. It's actually considerably more radical, based on my reading of it, than even what we have here on the ballot in Florida. This thing in Arizona is just bonkers. This is like an abortion free-for-all, basically. Horrible, horrible stuff. So the question then becomes whether or not articulating a 15-week, 20-week, whatever abortion ban, which again would really not have the practical effect of actually limiting a ton of abortions because the overwhelming majority are done much earlier in the gestational cycle than that. But the question politically becomes, I suppose, whether or not condemning this 1864 law and thereby supporting a more moderate measure would somehow salvage unborn babies in Arizona by dissuading people from voting for the radical pro-abortion ballot initiative on the ballot this fall. I guess that's an argument. I don't find it particularly persuasive. More generally speaking, Republicans just can't have it both ways. You have Donald Trump at the national level, who has made clear his Stephen Douglas-esque states' rights approach to the issue on the national stage. Okay, I understand that. I actually am not personally super, super peeved about that. I would prefer he stake out a 15 or 20 week national abortion ban as a federal backstop, but I understand why he's not doing so. It would be nice if he would be able to articulate the pro-life principle while he is simultaneously engaging in a prudential tactical retreat. That is what great statesmen have done over the time, but okay, I mean, that's not necessarily who Donald Trump is or what he does, but that's at the national level. At the state level, even under the states' rights paradigm, as we were just discussing earlier in the show in the case of Florida, at the state level, guys, stand for life unless you actually never believed a word that you said. I mean, that basically is what's going on here, isn't it? Do you actually believe that the unborn child maturing in the womb has an inalienable right to life? Do you actually believe that, or were you just saying it for many years now? If you want to go Stephen Douglas at the national level, somewhat ironically on Lincolnian prudential grounds, okay, I can kind of sort of get behind that. My syndicated column coming out tomorrow is on this, and I take somewhat of a nuanced take in it. But at the state level, again, even under a conceded states' rights paradigm, you've got to stand your ground at least a little bit. You cannot start running away from this issue, or else we're just going to get radical abortion on demand throughout the entire pregnancy, probably taxpayer funded, God forbid, while we're at it here in America. So I am just very disheartened right now at the way that Republicans are talking about this issue. I will end, though, on a positive note, which is that yesterday the Arizona legislature, some folks there, especially the Democrats there, started to make a legislative move to actually repeal this 1864 law. It was House Democrats and at least one Republican were trying to open discussion on a repeal. And then Republican leaders there in the Arizona legislature actually cut off the debate twice and quickly adjourned the session for the week. And then you had some Democrats waving their fingers and shouting shame, as these crazy lefties tend to do. Well, good for the Arizona legislature. So I will end there on a positive note. We will see how long their spines continue to be stiffened out there in the Grand Canyon state. Up next in today's closing argument, I'm about to get on a plane to fly to Massachusetts. Well, what am I doing there tonight? I think you're going to want to hear about this. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's time for today's closing argument. Well, today's closing argument, just want to put in a plug for a debate that I am doing this evening in Cambridge, Massachusetts, hosted by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. This is going to be a two-on-two debate, and here is the framing of the resolution as agreed upon by the host institution, ISI, as well as all four debate participants, yours truly included. A debate. In light of the terrorist attack on October 7th and the ensuing war in Gaza, what are the proper limits of speech on campus? So that is the debate that we are going to be debating tonight here. We are essentially talking about the Claudine Gay, Liz McGill, Sally Kornbluth congressional testimony from early December, whether or not calls for mass murder and genocide of a certain people, and in this case, the most genocided people in human history, the Jews, whether or not this is somehow, quote unquote, protected speech on campus. You can tell by my way of explaining the issue that I tend to take a skeptical position, and I agree with Congresswoman Elise Stefanik and those who are grilling Claudine Gay that calling for genocide of a certain people is not, quote unquote, protected speech there. So it's going to be a fascinating debate. My debate partner here is going to be my good friend Arthur Millick, who is the executive director of the Claremont Institute's Center for the American Way of Life in Washington, D.C. Our two foes who we are going to be debating against are Randall Kennedy, who is a left-leaning Harvard Law School professor, and then Shadi Hamid, who is a left-leaning columnist of the Washington Post, as well as a longtime fellow at the Brookings Institution. So it should be a really fun and engaging debate, hoping it's not going to get protested or shouted down or any kind of shenanigans like that. And you can go ahead and learn much more about this if you just go to ISI.org. That is where all the information about tonight's debate will be. I've also been sharing the links on social media. You can go ahead and live stream it. So even if you're not there in Massachusetts, you can go ahead and enjoy. And I hope that you do exactly that. But for now, that's been another episode here of America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Hope you enjoyed, as always. We'll be right back with you tomorrow morning.